Hello and welcome to a News Roast live special. My name is Jolyon Rubinstein, and a number of weeks ago, I was lucky enough to be invited by the Sheffield Documentary Festival to interview satire's modern doyen, private eye editor, team captain of Have I Got News For You? That's right, Ian Hislop. We had a lovely chat about post-truth, about the state of satire, and about that bloody general election that happened. So what we've decided to do is give you a special bonus episode where you're going to hear Ian and I discussing all manner of madness with a crowd of people clapping and cheering along, generally not for me, but for Ian, who they were really there to see. And, you know, I had to remind myself of that, because sometimes when you're an ego like me, you've got to look in the mirror and say, Jolyon, this isn't about you. No one gives a rocks about you being here. They're here for the Hislop. Except when we were walking into the theatre, the person who actually ran the theatre, and I'm talking about the usher, he was like, oh my God, you're Jolyon Rubinstein. I was like, yeah, thanks, mate. And I walked in, and then Ian walked in. He was like, sorry, mate, have you got a ticket? And I was like, yes, at least the young people know me. So that's my egocentric, narcissistic comment for the day. You enjoy this.
Ah. Hello, Sheffield. So it is my great, great pleasure to welcome to Sheffield Documentary Festival for the first time the doyen of British satire, Ian Hislop. Goodness me. You should think about running for office.
Can I just apologise first for not wearing my label? I arrived at the station and thought, my God, Sheffield's been taken over by the Orange Order.
It's DUP through and through here, mate. So, Ian, what's the naughtiest thing you've ever done?
I called an election early.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't go quite as planned, though, did it?
Not really, no.
No. So, let's go back to the very, very beginning, when...
I wasn't there.
I know, well... We're not going to talk about the LSD trips here. We're not going to talk about that. Just to be clear, Ian has never done LSD. The time when you were creating a satirical magazine called Passing Wind at Oxford University.
Yes, it was a subtle title.
It was, indeed.
Very bad when it came to selling advertising. Going to shops in the high street saying, you want to take out an ad, we're very classy. What's the title of your student publication? It's Passing Wind. No,
nice.
Thank you.
And you started collaborating with Nick Newman.
Yes. We're a pretty diverse background, Nick and I. We were at school together. minor public school on the South Coast, which I think covers all the bases.
Absolutely. That's pretty much the entire political establishment, isn't it?
Thank you.
But you, and when you were doing that, you had an interview with Richard Ingrams, who at the time was the editor of Private Eye.
Yes, my plan when I was editor of this student magazine was to interview all my heroes and then ask them for a job. it's not the primary function of publications, but I thought that would work for me. And I interviewed Peter Cook, which was incredibly exciting. He owned Private Eye. He was the major contributor. And then Richard Ingrams. Actually, when I came in, someone asked to see my bag and didn't know who I was, which is very kind. And I was about to say, do you know who I am? But then I remember I went to a club in Soho with Peter Cook, and there was a man in front of us, and he said, do you know who I am? And Peter grabbed the tannoy and said, there's a man here who doesn't know who he is. if anyone's got... I don't know. If anyone's got any idea, he's quite short, quite fat. So that was my proprietor, who was an extraordinary man.
Yeah, let's talk about that. What was the relationship like? I mean, that's an amazing thing for such a stalwart of satirical comedy at the time to have been owning a magazine like that. How was your relationship with him as proprietor and editor? How did that work?
Well, Peter was the ideal proprietor in that he owned the magazine but had no say at all in how it was run. His only function was to provide money and then turn up at court cases and take you out for lunch. And Peter's idea of lunch never involved any food, so he turned up to a case once, and Robert Maxwell, who some of you may remember, used to own the Mirror, and Peter turned up, and we were being sued, and it was quite serious, and Peter's idea of helping the court case was to stand at the back and wave his checkbook at Maxwell.
Amazing. So is it true that the first article that you wrote that appeared in 1980 was a parody of the Observer magazine's Room of My Own, where it described an IRA prisoner on a dirty protest decorating his cell in a fetching brown?
Yes, that was the first. Yes, bad taste. Always worth a try.
Well, it's important, isn't it? I mean, what is in bad taste nowadays in your mind?
Well, again, I thought that it was a very liberal newspaper and it was the middle of all that, and it was the idea that you would have a feature in which, usually a room of one's own, someone had brought in an interior designer, and you would just have a picture of someone doing the walls in a sort of lovely shade of taupe. yes, it got that sort of reaction at the time. People were never sure, but I think Ingram's decided that there was something odd about me, and maybe he would try and put in some more of my stuff.
It is incredible, though. I mean, you became editor of Private Eye at 26.
I did. And a lot of middle-aged men were very, very cross. And were I there now, I would be one of them. I would be incredibly cross and think, what on earth was he doing? It must have been mad.
John Lloyd said to me once, satire is a young man's game. Do you agree?
No, obviously. I think it's very much someone of a, you know, their late 50s is the perfect maturity. I think you've got to be sort of, I think you've got to have a slightly youthful sense of humour, possibly a mental age of 8.
Helps.
I think it's sort of, young men are very good at it, and there's lots of really brilliant young people doing satire at the moment, you know, which is annoying, obviously.
It is.
But, I mean, I don't think it's something you lose. Satire isn't, it's more of an attitude of mind. You essentially see the world in a particular way, and most satirists will say you're told what the official version of events is, and you say, I'm not sure that's true. I mean, it doesn't amount to a huge amount more than that. But it's very helpful, and there are times when, socially, I think it's very, very useful.
So can we bring up the image two, which is the Brexit title? Lovely title there.
Oh, yes.
So what's going on there, then?
I think that was an outbreak of Little Englanderism over Gibraltar. Of all the things we could be worried about with Brexit, suddenly Gibraltar hadn't been included in the piece of paper, largely because, I mean, that current administration, which is no longer current, didn't seem to have much of an eye for detail. You may have noticed. Things kept appearing in manifestos or not appearing. You know, Conservative Manifesto point one, pensioners, let's take their money away. Again, as Tory policies go, that's not very effective, unless you do it after the election,
yeah,
when you haven't told people, which is traditional Tory policy. Again, they don't seem to be very good at the politics. And that was Boris. I mean, the thought that he's coming back is just so extraordinary.
Oh, don't worry, he's going to be with Michael Gove. They're going to be totally fine.
Well, I think Michael Gove's been appointed as a sort of firewall. is there anyone who hates Boris more than I do? Let's have him in the cabinet.
strong and stable.
Yeah.
So you sort of have decried the ferocity with which some people have tried to defend the Brexit result.
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
I felt the discourse had become toxic, that seemed to me one of the failings of that period of politics, is essentially to say, well, anyone who voted Leave is a racist, bigot, moron, And anyone who voted Remain is a, you know, metropolitan elite, late 50-year-old public school wanker, which is partly true.
Well, in one case.
No, I felt the characterisation of the two camps was incredibly unhelpful, and just the level of fury. Mm. And part of my problem was that I am blatantly a Ramoner. I'm not pretending I'm anything other. There were a number of people on the Leave side for whom this was their first engagement with politics. And it was very difficult for them to come to the realisation that in politics, other people don't always agree with you. So by saying it again more loudly doesn't make it true. And you don't win the argument by saying Hitler.
Ken Livingstone, take note.
Yeah. And so this, I mean, that was, I think, became a real problem. But I mean, satirically, it was incredibly funny because Private Eye found itself under attack from all camps for not 100% adhering to other people's point of view. And I mean, it came to the fore with Theresa May saying she had a problem in that Westminster was divided. It's the Houses of Parliament, it's meant to be divided. There's the government and then there's the opposition parties, and that is the point of it. And she seemed to have forgotten that. And then she said Westminster was divided and the country was united, which was a unique perception.
That's quite incredible. So didn't a vicar write to you?
Vicars are always writing to me.
But particularly to bemoan the coverage post-Brexit.
Oh, yes. I mean, he was a very nice vicar. He wrote me a letter saying, you know, what
nice
bit of the referendum result don't you understand? Suck it up, you shit. He said, the majority won. Get over it. So I wrote him a letter saying, dear Reverend, lovely to get your letter. I do think members of a church who began with a minority of 12 should be careful about defending the majority vote entirely, particularly when this minority vote shrunk to one on Good Friday. Occasionally my church background helps. Anyway, he wrote me a very contrite letter. But people got absolutely furious, and I did try and point out that the level of this was mad. I mean, it was... Private Eye is particularly susceptible to readers who suddenly find that their point of view is being challenged. Mm. And they're very keen on other people's views being challenged because they're wrong.
Yeah.
But theirs... So we had the Scots Nats, who, again, one issue, people who are quite new to the idea of debate, they didn't like it much. The UKippers... You know, late in life, had come to the idea that Brussels runs everything. Well, yes, not entirely. Then the Corbynites, a lot of sick form politics there. How dare you question Jeremy? Well, that is sort of the point. That is allowed. So they were furious. Then the Lib Dems, and now the Tories. They're really cross.
They are, aren't they?
And there was some man who came up to me in the street and said, I've seen a lot of your covers. Which are pretty disgusting. But when there were floods in Somerset, I mean, you know, people lost their homes. And I said, right, we're allowed to put war, death, famine and terrorism, but not floods in the home counties.
It's a strange
thing. Do write
thing.
In, please.
Yeah, yeah, do. We must move forward because we have limited time. You said after Trump was elected... One is unsure whether to feel relieved at the sense of déjà vu or worried about the possibility of history repeating itself not as a farce but as a tragedy again. What did you mean?
That comment came off the back of a joke. I'd put up a lookalike of Donald Trump and Mussolini.
Can we have that cover, please? Is that OK? Trump cover?
I'd made the point that when Mussolini rose to power, Orwell had pointed out that, A, he never tells the truth, he makes stuff up, he attacks the mainstream media, he's incapable of consistency, and everyone thought he was a joke. You know, he was known as the clown before he took power and started killing people. Mm. So I was saying that it is not as though we have never been here before, but trying to learn lessons from history, it's either let's be careful, let's not be too pessimistic, but let's not assume what's funny doesn't turn into something worse.
Mm.
So that was the point I was trying to make there. The point I was trying to make there is more obvious.
I don't know. It's pretty sophisticated. I'm not sure I'm getting it.
But that, I mean, again, that cover, it's a small pleasure, but it was reproduced and much circulated in America,
mm.
and his press spokesman said he thought it was offensive. So that was a small victory.
Yes!
And I don't know, he may well have thought it was a proper newspaper.
I mean, he probably did.
We were banned in America for a while, Private Eye. We were listed by one of the university departments as fake news. And we had to ring up this academic and say, some of this stuff that you've accused us of is a joke.
Well, they famously fell for the thing in The Onion as well, didn't they?
They've got yes, a kind they of listed habit them. Of, well, they had a picture we'd put up of the Queen signing a book in which we'd said she was signing the protest against Trump. and they'd said, well, you know, the Queen didn't sign that protest. This is fake news.
So we are so proud that this week News Roast is sponsored by Cornerstone. What is Cornerstone, hey?
Cornerstone, mate, is a flexible subscription-based service where you can tailor your shaving supplies and delivery frequency to meet your facial needs.
With the new Cornerstone razor, the real difference you'll notice is in the quality and smoothness of the shave, thanks to the three-step engineering process pioneered by their new factory in Germany.
The full details can be found at cornerstone.co.uk/roast,
where you'll also find more information on how they will even engrave chrome-plated handles on your new Cornerstone razor with initials. Fancy.
You can customise each box with other shaving products to suit your needs, so you can try out their full range of balms and creams to keep you silky smooth and arrange to have them delivered as often as you need them.
Prices range from about £14 to £30 per box per month, and listeners to our podcast get £10 off their first box. So, what? People... you need to go to cornerstone.co.uk/roast or enter the promo code ROAST10. So that's uppercase ROAST10 at the checkout. Check this bad boy out. It's going to be great.
So Private Eye is doing pretty well. I read that since launching 55 years ago, it's got its highest circulation figures of
yes,
all time.
Yes, which is extraordinary, which I'm very pleased about because I love print and I think print can do things that other media can't do. It's fantastic with cartoons. It's fantastic with the serendipity of finding a piece and then finding another piece and then reading both of them and putting them together. We continually survive. I mean, Private Eye does two things. We essentially make jokes about things you know about and try and tell you things you don't know. Mm. Jokes and journalism. It's a very, very simple format. The late, great Paul Foote, who's my great friend and a great journalist, said, essentially, people read Private Eye for the jokes and then later on the toilet they read my pieces. which, again, was typically self-deprecating. But that's what we do. And the combination, I think particularly now in an era where people are very uncertain what to believe, to find somewhere. I mean, the idea of Private Eye as a journal of record is sort of hysterical. But there is a desire for unfiltered news and for fairly detailed stories about things that would normally be considered boring. But I think this election, if anything, has shown that... the fact that we run, you know, 2,000 words about the health service every issue is not boring. It's quite interesting.
Absolutely.
And that one of the great eye topics, I mean, which is the change, really, from when I took over, is money is what is interesting. Sex is less so, particularly in terms of politics or in terms of people's lives.
Absolutely.
And that, again, making quite complex financial stories interesting. I mean, this is... what documentary makers face all the time. This is a subject which is not sexy. There aren't any pictures. What, we got a picture of a pound note again? This is a limited partnership. How do we illustrate that?
Sexy limited partnerships.
But, I mean, really, it's all in the skill of the craft, really, in writing it and finding it out, in making the research sing. And then, as soon as it's out there, you can do jokes about it. I mean, you know, there's me wanging on about, you know, Wahhabi Salafism. Again, a bit of a special subject for some years. But the Saudi contribution to the spread of a particular form of Islam is... A, really interesting, and B, in the way they behave, incredibly funny. They've essentially dumped a vast amount of toxic waste on the rest of the world and said, us? Not here.
It's cool. As long as we can keep selling them planes, it's not a problem.
No, or indeed anything else.
So the issue, I think, sometimes that I sort of see more and more clearly that Private Eye seems to provide is getting ahead of the news, whether it was the expenses scandal or corporate tax avoidance.
Yeah.
You were years ahead of it becoming a story. Why do you think that is? Is it because you employ so many more investigative journalists? Is it because other papers don't?
No, other papers are much richer than us.
Don't mind if you get sued on.
A, they're much more cautious now. People don't like investigative journalism, I mean, on the whole, employers. It takes too long. Sometimes nothing happens. Someone says, I've got a great story, and then 2 months later they haven't. It didn't work out. So you've got nothing, and you've got no copy, and you've spent a lot of money. If the story does work out and it's really good, someone sues you. and then you lose money to the lawyers. I mean, it's essentially not what proprietors who want to make money do. So you need... essentially liberal newspapers which are covered by profits elsewhere or a desire to do it. And one of the things that Private Eye can always do is repeat. People say to me, you ran that tax story about 35 times. and I said, yeah, and finally you read it. and essentially the idea of corporate tax evasion, there was a very brilliant man called Richard Brooks who was... quite a senior official in Her Majesty's Customs Department. We lured him over to the dark side. He started off as a whistleblower and then turned into a fantastic journalist. And uniquely for our profession, Richard understands a balance sheet. He's very, very good at detail. And from being an idea that he was obsessed by in his bedroom, 5 years later, it was the top of the G20 agenda.
Yeah.
And that is what you can achieve by... saying, I think this is interesting. You know, I really do think these people should pay some tax, and they don't. And they don't pay a little. They don't pay anything.
Yeah.
And the amounts involved are absolutely enormous.
It is
and
staggering.
By banging on about that, it comes into the public agenda. And as soon as it's half in, you can make jokes about it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, without Private Eye, it wouldn't have been reported in the other papers. Without that, the revolution we televised wouldn't have been able to talk about Starbucks, Amazon, Vodafone. And Jeremy Corbyn was literally running on that as part of his platform, which I'm sure you're over the moon about.
Well, I was fascinated to see in the Labour Party manifesto there was a credit to Private Eye for some of the research on offshore. And I thought it's come to a sorry pass in this country.
It has.
When that's your source of information.
We've got relatively little time, so I'm actually going to skip over talking about Spitting Image, but I must ask one question.
Oh,
no! I must ask one question. You got a choice, Spitting Image and Have I Got News For You, but a bit less? Yeah? Good. Right, Spitting Image. We'll go back to Spitting Image. Is it true that in Spitting Image there was a puppet of yourself that used to appear in the back of sketches?
Yes.
Amazing.
And so much is the loyalty between satirists that after I left the programme, it immediately appeared in a starring role.
Can we get the Thatcher clip up, please? Is that OK? From Spitting Image.
Nothing.
Norman, I distinctly saw your lips move. If you've got something to say, you can say it to the whole cabinet.
Shut up,
Norman. Speak up, man, for God's sake. Say what you mean. You're not on the platform now.
Nigel pinched my pen.
Nigel.
He did.
Is this true? You know my policy on stealing from one's friends? Cabinet. What do we call it when people go around stealing other people's property? You!
A free market economy?
Rubbish! What do we call it, David?
Socialism.
Well done, David. Perhaps we can get on with the nasty business of the unemployment statistics. Now, 5 years ago, I asked you all to have a look at them at home and bring along any ideas. Jeffrey, let's hear yours, shall we?
I did do them, honestly, but I left them on the bus.
I say, write out 1,000 times, I must not use London transport.
Oh, wow. So, let's talk about Spitzky Image. How did you first get involved in the project?
I'd been working on Private Eye with my friend Nick Newman for a while and done a little bit of television and got employed by John Lloyd. And Nick and I were almost the only writers who were interested in politics. So we got that bit of it to write. And it was, I mean, again, we were in our sort of late 20s, and it was probably early 20s, actually. You can see, I mean, that sketch is entirely about being at school. I mean, we'd barely left. It was incredibly good fun to write for, but also, as a writer, you realise that in the end, the script wasn't that vital. What was the pleasure was of puppets hitting each other.
Yeah.
And as the years went on, we just started putting at the end of sketches puppety business, in which the puppeteers would just smack each other in the face. And that would be it. I mean, the best sketch we ever wrote was Norman Tebbit, his idea for liquidising the unemployed. and he'd sort of, there was this fantastic scene where he'd sort of put his own arm in it and it just all went in this blender, which is an idea I stole from Swift. which is quite literally just taken from his solution to the unemployed in Irish. What was brilliant about it, though, was the form of it, mm-hmm. and the fact that the puppets were the people, but they weren't. So they could do anything. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like actors doing it, when you might think that's poor taste, or I'm not sure that would happen. You could just do anything. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we left. Nick and I left. The night of the last election, and we did our final sketch was Tomorrow Belongs to Me, sung by the entire cabinet with an angelic schoolboy in a bowler hat, which again, I mean, it was live. I'm quite sure it wouldn't go
it's
out
incredible,
now.
Incredible, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I for one certainly want it back. Do you want it back? Come on.
Yeah.
Spitting Image coming back. Be great. So let's talk about that little known show, Have I Got News for You?
Yes.
Has anyone heard of that show? It's a bit of a small deal. Just won a BAFTA recently, no biggie. So let's talk. It's true, you are the only person to have appeared in every single episode.
Yes.
Even filming the seventh series, despite suffering from appendicitis.
yes. I had appendicitis and I went to St. George's in Tooting. And they put me on a trolley in a corridor, which is fairly standard.
Well, that's standard policy now, isn't
it? Yeah, standard policy. No, I was lucky to get a trolley.
Yeah, exactly.
Could easily have been in an orange box. so I was there for about 4 hours, and I thought, nothing's happening here. No one's going to... And I'm going to miss the recording, so I discharged myself. I went back to the studio... and I sat there, and no one noticed. I was about as grumpy as I normally am. and I did the show, and then it suddenly hit me. And I ran back, got a cab, and went back to Tooting, where I went into A&E this time. And they did an emergency operation.
Good lad,
which
good lad.
Was terrific. And I've always said that's a mark of my dedication to the show. And Paul Merton said it's because you're so desperate you'll be replaced.
Can we have clip 7,
probably
please?
True.
This is the news that fearing Kirsty would give her too easy a ride on Newsnight, Theresa May subjected herself to the one show. Which member of Theresa's team was trusted to appear alongside her?
It was her husband, Philip.
Mm. I mean, it was obviously a tough interview. They went straight in with, do you like shoes?
Mm. Yes.
Yes, Alex and Matt, the grand inquistadores.
Did she?
Yes, she did like shoes, as long as they were strong and stable.
Amazing.
So Ian, there's a wonderful cartoon in this issue by a man called Stoko, which is of a bin with Teresa upside down outside number 10 and her husband just wheeling it out.
Philip, who they failed to look at all in that interview and say, do you happen to represent a lot of tax-avoiding companies that have trillions of dollars under assets?
No, they let them hang themselves. He's very funny, Josh Widdicombe, yeah. And the last leg's very good.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's quite a lot of really quite good satire.
What else do you like? I mean, I'm a big fan of John Oliver.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not that bothered by those American shows because I just think, well, in America, you need to get almost all your news and all your interviews from those shows. In Britain, you know, you think, well, we've got people who interview people well. We've got quite good documentary makers. We've got quite good news programs. So I see them occasionally. But again, I think their take on Britain is never... I'm very parochial. I mean, that's what I'm interested in, is how Britain works.
But aren't we in a sort of state
and seeing,
now
I remember turning on once and someone saying, so you guys, I mean, you're discussing buses? And you think, yeah, local bus is quite important to quite a lot of people in Britain. So, yes, we are.
Yeah.
What, you're discussing trains? There's a sort of parochialism that goes both sides of the Atlantic.
But it feels to me like there is a lack of new satirical formats that are coming out of the broadcasters.
I'm not sure, actually. I keep seeing things that I think are really, really good.
What do you like? Tell us
The thing that came out of QI, No Such Thing as the News, I thought that was
really
funny.
Yeah, that was very, very good, yeah.
You know, I think there's quite a lot of it. I think it's a sort of slightly boring old man's thing, as you say, well, there's nothing any good in our day.
Yeah.
And I suppose one of the benefits of my education is the first time I read a piece saying that there's nothing any good anymore and actors are paid too much and teachers don't make any money was in the works of Juvenal, writing in 100 AD, who wrote exactly that. And you have got to be careful it's all going to the dogs. Well, often it isn't.
Well, it's good. I mean, you know, we're sitting here today in Sheffield Documentary Festival discussing it. Now, you said once, satire is bringing ridicule of vice, folly and humbug. All the negatives imply a set of positives. Certainly in this country, you go around saying, that's wrong, that's corrupt. If you have some feeling that it should be better than that, people say, you satirists attack everything. Well, we don't actually. That's the whole point.
Yes, I mean, I was quoting Alexander Pope, who was a great English satirist, who, again, he set a lot of the parameters of what's worth doing. And essentially, it's finding your targets, targeting the strong rather than the weak. Mm. And he wrote that people who were, in his world, safe from the bar, the pulpit and the throne, yet touched and shamed by ridicule alone. I mean, this is a long time ago, but the principle holds. Mm. And I think people say, and people often said to me, oh, well, you're such a cynic, which implies I don't believe in anything. I'm not. I'm a skeptic. I like to look at things and say, is that true? Mm. And if it is true, fine. And also, I mean, why would you spend as much time as journalists, documentary makers, satirists do trying to point out things that are wrong if you didn't think it was worth getting them right? Mm. You just wouldn't do it.
What are the things?
Here's an hour program about abuse in care homes.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't produce that because you think it doesn't really matter what happens in care homes. I don't care. I mean, you know, the negative does imply a positive.
What are the things that you think are the most pressing issues that we're facing now after this election?
Facing this election, well, getting through Brexit in the least damaging possible way. Mm. But then I would say that.
But it does seem almost impossible with the House so divided that you could possibly negotiate anything in a strong and stable way. Are we going to be seeing another election?
I think there will be another election, unfortunately. Mm. I'm not sure people are very thrilled at the prospect.
Goody.
I mean, obviously, it's good for us.
No, it's great for us.
Because it's quite funny. Gove has been reappointed. What do you want? Comedy.
Maybe another Game of Thrones video from him.
I'm a big fan of Teresa's. I mean, that isn't even an exaggeration. That's a lie.
So, a new film that you're making is about immigration.
Sorry, this is my only credentials for being here. I have made a documentary. Yeah. I mean, I have made a couple.
Because we've got limited time, I'm not going to show both clips. Let's show clip 10 with the wonderful Katie Hopkins.
Referred to a plague of feral humans. I mean, are they all feral? I mean, is it actually a plague? Aren't they just a group of people?
It's because you look at them and think, you are nothing like me. You don't understand how our culture works. You think it's OK to molest a young boy in a swimming pool. You think it's OK to rape women.
You've met these people. Haven't you met any asylum seekers who you've talked to and thought, you're an ordinary human being? You're not a feral human being?
I think these individuals from some of these cultures they come from are feral humans. I stand by those words. I use those words explicitly. I think I reflect the national conversation. And I don't see that as hatred, and I don't see that as distrust or mistrust. I see that as people wanting to protect the thing they love. And, you know, this would be an interesting thing about...
But do they do that by hating the other?
I don't see that.
No, I'm just
all.
Reading your stuff thinking this is filled with hate, isn't it? A lot of it. You really hate this, you hate that, you hate... It's part of the
very...
shock genre, isn't it?
If someone's been around for 12 years or so, speaking their version of truth with a now massive audience, there's a reason that that gains support. And it isn't to do with speaking hate or whipping up frenzies or making people anti a yellow peril, using your words. It's because there is a sense that there is a whole world of stuff we can no longer say. And it's because there's a whole world of state media that appear to be very biased in a particular direction. It's because of people like you that there are people like me. And I've always said this, that you guys, the liberal elite in London, are responsible for me. You are Dr. Frankenstein, and I am your monster.
Oh, Ian! So she's your fault! I knew it!
Yep.
My favourite part of that, I've watched that four times today, is my version of true.
Mm.
What do you think she means by my version of true?
I mean, the terrible thing about making documentaries is you have to listen to people.
Did you see his face throughout that documentary?
I much prefer it when I talk. That seems to be much better television. But anyway, the point of that is the documentary is looking at the first big immigration scare in this country, the first time mass immigration blew up into the national debate. And I asked Katie Hopkins specifically because there was a scare about Chinese immigrants, the yellow peril, and a lot of the tabloid and popular newspapers had just started, and this was an enormous story for them. The Chinese were going to come over here in absolute hordes, and they were going to turn all women into white slaves. They were opium fiends, and they had criminal gangs. And the newspapers loved it. And there was one piece, which was a particular expose of this, which I asked her to read, because it contained the phrase that the Chinese were a festering sore, which was exactly the phrase that she had used describing immigrants X hundred years later. And I was trying to get her to see that the yellow peril scare and some of what she had written were quite similar. This backfired in that she loved the piece.
Amazing.
And thought it had really got it on the head. And what I am trying to do in this documentary, again, takes a fairly short time frame from a period when Britain had no immigration restrictions at all, nothing. There were no border controls. The Victorians thought anyone could come here with nothing. No visa, passport, job application, letter, nothing. Anyone could come here because Britain was so marvellous. Why wouldn't you want to come here? And if you came here, you'd probably contribute in the end and it would be marvellous. That was the Victorian position. Then there was a wave of immigration, 1890s onwards, and a wave of scares. The yellow peril was the worst example of a scare.
Mm.
There was a report commissioned into the Chinese straight after the big scare, and it was found out that the local police commissioner could find no crime at all. There wasn't any reported. They were working in laundries, and a number of laundry owners said, we can't get any local labour. No one wants to work in the laundry, so we've employed Chinese people. And almost everything that was hyped up was untrue. And then Winston Churchill, who comes out extremely well in this documentary, he was a great fan of immigration and open-door policies, he asked in Parliament, we've read a lot about the yellow peril, you know, that's coming over here. How many Chinese people are there in Britain? And it was a couple of hundred.
Amazing.
Not 100,000, 100. Mm. And this was, I mean, the point of making historical documentaries is, if possible, to try and anticipate and rehearse some of the same things that turn up again and again. And the yellow peril was I think, the most. I mean, Fu Manchu arose as a character out of this, the idea of the mysterious East coming over to take over Britain when it was a few laundries.
And that's amazing.
That was it. And then the speeches came up, as they always do. They're British jobs being lost. I mean, they were mostly Irish jobs, actually. And they'd just come in the 10 years before. I mean, the immigrant waves are... particularly at this point, very, very obvious in what they do. So that's what the documentary is about.
When is it out?
It's out in about Thursday, the 22nd of June.
On BBC Two.
On BBC Two. And I'm glad you picked that bit. No, I'm not. But, I mean, there are... Alan Johnson is in the film talking about Labour and the immigration policies to Eastern Europe. Baroness Varzi is in the film talking about how loyal do you have to be as an immigrant, and which, again, is always the second thing. They undercut jobs, they're a pressure on infrastructure, and they're not loyal. I mean, the Jews, they're basically loyal to a force outside, and every succeeding wave, and these arguments come up. She's very good on that.
I'm sure.
She said at one point, both my fathers fought for Britain in the Indian Army. How loyal do you want?
Yeah, exactly. Right, listen, we're going to throw it open to questions, so I'm going to take three at a time. I'm sorry we don't have longer for questions. As usual, we've gone a little over. So if you put your hand up, there are people in the orange tops. They will come round. Okay, see, I can see one. This gentleman here. Any other questions this side? Okay, that hand that is gesticulating to me hugely over there. Any ladies? Any ladies? Yeah, this lady up here. So we'll take all three of those questions.
Ian, why are your excellent podcasts so infrequent?
Yeah, I was just wondering, the whole idea sort of post-truth to me seems to come from a sort of Foucauldian archaeology of history kind of idea. And the obvious answer to that would seem to be, ironically, a Foucauldian panoptic idea. But do you think there's like a better, less invasive way to deal with kind of post-truth than sort of a universal panoptic?
I don't even know what that means. Okay, and up here.
Are you really enjoyed your talk? Tomorrow is a very special day. It's President Trump's 71st birthday.
Right.
Do you have any intentions on celebrating it?
I paid someone to jump out of a cake.
Okay, so we have Trump's birthday podcasts and...
And the panoptic.
Yeah.
The podcast is produced by a young person.
It's amazing.
I don't have a huge amount to do with it, and that's probably why it's very good. It's just a question of... Private Eye's a pretty small team, so if we're doing one about health or if we're doing one about export finance, or if we're doing one about social care, it will be the same voice. It is the same person. And essentially, I don't want them doing podcasts when they should be filling the magazine.
So
it is a question of resources. And because we are a pretty tight unit. And as you know, my approach to digital media is fairly rigid. There's a French magazine called Le Canard Enchaîné, which the eye is essentially modelled on, and their website says in French, go and buy the magazine. And if I were a bit braver, that's what I'd do. As it is, we have a few things. But that's it. So I think the podcasts are great, and it's our journalists talking in depth about stories that they run. Mm. But we haven't got that many of them, so we don't do it that often. And we're trying not to dilute the quality. So I'm sorry about that.
Let's go on to the special word and then post-truth.
Yes. It was. I'm afraid I didn't really follow that. It was... What approach do we need to deal with post-truth?
Is that basically it?
Yeah, basically, is there a better way of doing it than essentially sort of having everybody monitor each other all the time for right. some sort of unified version of truth?
Okay, I get that.
Yeah. I think crowdsourcing the truth is probably the way to do it.
Mm.
Obviously, because I come from a tradition where you have a few authoritative sources, it is good if they take on, for example, Trump all the time. But the American newspapers, and I have some friends on the New York Times, got to a point where they said, we don't know what to say anymore. Traditionally, as a journalist, you say, well, you said that then, and now you say that. And Trump goes, yeah. Or you go, you said that, and it's absolutely untrue. And he goes, no, it isn't.
It's amazing.
That's the end of that.
I'm going to take two more quick questions, both from women, please, because we've had some guys. This lady here... up there. I can maybe grab a third one down here.
If you were braver, what else might you do?
Okay, if you were braver, interesting question.
If there is another election and Jeremy Corbyn wins,
yes.
and he has to meet Donald Trump,
amazing.
What do you think would happen?
That's an amazing question. And then up here.
Hi, you said early on that you thought that there were a lot of young men that were good at satire. Do you think it's a male domain, satire? Oof.
Right, big shout. Yeah, okay, I'm being pointed at loudly.
It's a good point.
Absolutely, it is. It is a good point.
Do you want me to start with that, or do you want me
Yeah,
to...
I mean, literally, we're going to be... okay, certainly from, I think, both perspectives, no, it is not just a male domain.
Oh, so you're going to answer it?
Well, you tell me. You tell me. Tell me what
no,
you
I,
think.
I was. Have we got time to answer these questions?
They're shouting at us, but we'll do quickly one
more. Right, OK. No, it's not exclusively, but young men are more conditioned and better at putting themselves forward. If I say I would like some new cartoonists, I get a shedload of men and almost no women. On Have I Got News For You, every woman, more or less, who you would imagine has been invited, has. A lot of them say no because they don't think they'd be any good. All men say yes, and often they are terrible.
Right. Oh, my God, they've just given us loads more time. Hooray! OK, we can have tons more questions. OK, so...
That's very nice. Well, do say if it's boring or if you've got something else to go yeah. to.
Get it, like, shout it, like, get off, get off.
No, you got well, 20
that
minutes.
That was a good question
yeah.
from the lady there, which was...
But it is important, isn't it? Why aren't there more sort of female satirists here?
There are, and I mean, we have... I think four really good female cartoonists. Catherine Lamb, you know, Griselda, who is, I think, almost the funniest we have. I mean, it's not that they can't do it, it's that they don't do it. And people, on the whole, who end up doing this stuff have been doing it for a very long time. People tend to start at school. You get a chance to get slightly better at university because no one's looking. You can run terrible magazines like I did. And eventually, you get to a point where it's polished enough to go in. And it's getting to that point, which I think is easier for young men. So you're quite right to pick me up on that. What would happen if Jeremy Corbyn was elected? Well, we've had an example in front of us of what happens if you have an adult in charge of your country with Mrs. Merkel dealing with a prime minister. The first thing she says is, you've behaved appallingly. And the second thing she says is, we don't support you on the following items. Then you turn your back. It was a fantastic summit, and there is nothing he can do about it. So I would imagine there's no point in refusing to engage. I mean, one of the, again, problems with people who've never thought or been involved in politics before is the idea that you can entirely retreat to your own country and sit there feeling good. You know, not even Norway and Sweden do that. Mm. They engage. They meet people who aren't very nice. I mean, that is part of it. You don't have to sell them weapons. You don't have to do what they say, but you do have to meet them. I mean, as Jeremy knows, he's met a lot of very not nice people.
Oh. Some more questions. Okay, sir, hands flailing up the top here.
A lot of the satire in the issue of private sector prior to the election seems predicated on an assumption of a Tory landslide.
Yeah.
Do you any predictions for the current situation?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's what we call preventative journalism. My job was to bring out the anti-May vote. And by suggesting that it was going to be a triumphal process of her in a gilded carriage, I think I did the job pretty bloody well. Mm. Can I just read something out, which for me is the funniest bit of the election? There's a roundup of people's predictions in this issue of Private Eye, which is very, very enjoyable. As the exit poll looms, I repeat my prediction. Conservatives will win by a 90 to 100 seat majority. That was Piers Morgan. Oh, dear.
It does
How
start writing itself.
How unfortunate that he should look so foolish.
Yes, this gentleman here, really, yes, okay, this gentleman here. It's, any more ladies that really want to have a split?
You see, they don't want to ask a question.
Okay, this lady here. Okay, yeah. Yes, yes. I'm there to you. So we'll start with you, sir.
Can we assume that the term post-truth indicated the presence of truth beforehand?
Great question.
Yes, I think we can. I think, again, Orwell did use it, and he used it particularly about the group of dictators in the 30s and 40s who were trying to move from an era where there was such a thing as an absolute truth. I mean, difficult in political terms, but you know what he meant, to an era where truth was whatever they said. And that, for him, was what had to be resisted, which is why he wrote 1984, why he wrote those wonderful things about black is white is black, 2 + 2 = 5, all of those reversals of truth, and the whole sort of characterization of telling lies so often that they get believed, indicated for him, and this absolutely Orwell believed, that there was a truth, a version. This did happen, and whether you said it didn't or not, it did happen. So I think as long as we're talking about post-truth, it means we vaguely remember that there was something that was true.
Hmm.
When we give up and we talk about my truth and it becomes an emotional reaction to the world, I'm cross, so therefore this is true, I mean, that's when it goes.
Lady up here.
Hello.
Oh. Oh, hello.
So I kind of wanted to know, in that clip of the documentary with the lovely Katie Hopkins,
yes,
was it difficult to kind of keep your cool when she was speaking such crap? I ask because I'm a sociologist working on my dissertation on Brexit. And right. As a Remainer, I'm going to have to kind of be careful of what I say when I ask Leave voters. So that's why I'm asking. And also, is she that much of a bitch in person that she is on media?
I mean, that appeared to be a statement of fact. it is a good question, but... I work with a very, very good outfit of documentary makers called Wingspan, who said, we think you should interview someone who takes a very robust view from the other side. And they didn't tell me who they had in mind. The other thing they're very good at pointing out in documentaries, which is, again, I work in a lot of combative media where you are essentially trying to confront people or get something out of people or... you know, make them change. Their view was that the way to approach that form of interviewing was to let the person talk. And the longer the person talked, the more they would reveal about themselves. So by the time we'd got to the end, Katie had got it into her head that I was probably the worst sort of liberal Ramona there'd ever been. She asked me at one point whether I'd ever been on the tube. And because I'd suggested that the London that she presented after the first the Waterloo Bridge that was locked down, reeling and cowed, didn't seem to be very like the London I was wandering about. But those sort of challenges in observational documentary or those sort of documentary are not very helpful. What you need is someone to tell you what they want. So, yes, I did find it difficult, but actually, luckily, I work for people who know what they're doing.
What did you make of her statement that that she is, you know, Frankenstein's child and that you are Professor Frank? What do you make of that?
Well, that was hurtful.
Yeah, I can imagine. The idea of birthing Katie Hopkins is quite terrifying.
Again, I mean, what I thought was interesting about that, and it was interesting about all of the sort of overblown press coverage historically, is it all starts with a kernel of truth. There weren't no Chinese people who came here. There weren't no Jews. There were 100,000 who came into the West End and occupied the West End, the East End, and occupied a tiny proportion of land. The sweatshops did employ people cheaper, and they did longer hours. Baroness Varzi's parents worked double shifts, and people didn't like it because they wanted to work single shifts. There is always something to start with that you can blow, and that's why these people are dangerous. And for her to say, you've invented me, by not talking openly about immigration, by allowing any discourse about immigration only to come from the right, was an error. So even again, God, I hate acknowledging the people who produced my shows, but even then you had to allow the kernel of truth. And that's why that thing, when she says it, it makes you think just a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, that was... some more questions. This gentleman here, and then we'll take another lady, please. Okay, that lady there, and then we'll come on to you, sir. So,
do you think how we're sourcing our information is changing away from the traditional, so away from newspapers, if that had any impact on the election, and have you seen it benefit in the private eye?
Yeah, I think we definitely are. I mean, this was not a great election for traditional newspapers. I mean, The Sun didn't win it. You know, the headline we put it in this time. It was The Sun what had no effect at all. You know, it's a new thing. Murdoch is reportedly absolutely incensed. I mean, he's always backed a winner before, and he's always called it. I mean, you know, Mrs. May did win, but he had no idea. And I think there is a sense in which, you know, the Daily Mail ran 9 pages, and I think even their readers were going, oh yes, Corbyn, he's the new leader of Hamas. Oh, yes, right. There's a caliphate established in Sheffield. And just, you know, went on to the bit about, you know, health matters and whether broccoli gives you cancer, you know, which is the core bit of the Daily Mail, really. The press did not distinguish itself in this election. And I think it showed a lack of reporting skills to start with, and then followed. And that's always followed by a lack of influence. Because if you don't know what's going on, you start commenting on not knowing what's going on. So, I mean, as I said, you know, essentially most of the political commentators in this country knew nothing and were way behind what was actually going on. I do think that... Sorry, you mentioned sourcing of it. I do think that's a problem, because you do need to have authoritative sources of information. Social media, for all its virtues, can create extraordinary bollocks incredibly fast. You know, you may think that's absurd, having just talked about the Mail or the Sun or whatever, but, I mean, it is incredible how fast it works and how fast it sticks. And people online, I think, don't tend to say, where is that coming from? Should I believe that? You know, I have a huge number of friends, and middle-aged people are just as bad as young people, and saying, I read online that Hillary Clinton murdered her lawyer, which, you know, I didn't know, and we're not being told this. And I'm saying, it may be that you're not being told this because it isn't true, and you should look at this stuff. Because, I mean, in the American election and, you know, in the Brexit and... not so much in this election, But in the French election, there was an enormous amount of stuff on social media which was unbelievable. The stuff about Macron that got planted, which a huge number of people looked at, was convincingly damning, but entirely unsourced. So all I'm saying is, yes, I think there is a shift, but I do think that you have to be very careful about where this stuff comes from.
So take this lady... Oh, you can tell there's a microphone over there. Right.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. I'm just interested, basically, in... you've obviously voted. What your actual...
How dare you?
I know. Sorry.
Think he's a voter? No, no, no.
Yeah, how much... I guess I would imagine that you should just kind of be impartial in what you're reporting, because you're a satirist, you're going to rip the mickey out of any party. But if the favourite party that you've got, if they get into power, how do you deal with that? Have they ever been in power? I have no idea.
Aren't you the chairman of the monster raving loony party?
I mean, I vote for the party who I disagree with least. Which, I think is perfectly reasonable democratically.
Absolutely.
And I do that every time. And I do it in my constituency and I do it on major issues. And I don't have a problem with it. I really like voting. I mean, I went down and voted in Sissinghurst, which is a village in Kent. It was just me. 7 o'clock in the morning in the church hall. But I just... it's a very, very special process. I don't pretend I don't enjoy it or think it's valuable. And I do it every time. And one of the first things Jolyon asked, because he's always been engaged with getting out the youth vote, one of the first documentaries I ever did for Channel 4, they said, we're trying to get the youth vote out. And I said, well, the major issues in this election are education and employment. And if young people aren't interested in that, well, they bloody well should be. And then I walked off. and the producer said, that's not what we want. We were hoping you'd say something about a failure of your generation to engage and trying new compromises. So I was cut.
How very dare they?
But, I mean, the revolution will be televised. My favourite sketch I ever did was the two of them on top of a bus shouting out to young people saying, don't vote, stay in bed, don't vote, it's much better for us, we'll carry on running everything, don't vote, don't. Which again, I mean, it's what satire can do. It absolutely crystallised a problem. And, you know, my limited take on the election, I think that a lot of people didn't turn up and vote for Brexit, were very cross at themselves as much as anything else, and then turned up this time. And that changed a lot of the patterns of voting that we've seen.
Mm. Right, where do we have the next microphone? Someone said, right, we'll have one here. Yep, one there, and then we'll have... There was someone who's feverishly raising up there. We will come, yep, up there next. Yes, down here, mate, we'll go next. So, up here.
Hello. Hi, how are you doing?
Oh, hang on. Sorry.
Sorry.
You're next. Go on.
Given that we've got cartoonish figures like Trump on the global stage and there are things happening which you couldn't really make up, do you think that makes it more difficult to produce satire at the moment, or are they making it easy for you?
Yeah, is it more difficult to produce satire?
No, I think satire is slightly more difficult when you have a character like Trump because he's so obviously absurd, but that doesn't seem to bother a lot of people. So you have to find out what the weaknesses are. I mean, if you say to Donald Trump, you're very rich and stupid, that doesn't bother him. If you say to him, nearly all your businesses lost money and you must be the only man in history who's run a casino where the house loses, you are clearly a total incompetent loser. That hurts. You have to find the bit that's underneath the grotesquery. And for satirists, that's what you should be doing, really. And with Trump, I think, the Saturday Night Live has been particularly good because they've really upped their game. And they don't just do Trump, they did that his press spokesman, which is a very, very good analysis of why questions aren't asked and aren't answered. I mean, you just have to be better. But I don't think anyone ever said, in the 30s or 40s when Orwell was writing, I wouldn't bother with any of those novels, George. You can't make it up. you know, he did. And again, often, I find in English literature, I mean, when we had Moseley and the Black Shirts, our best comic writer, P.G. Wodehouse, took him on by inventing a character who wore brown trousers and had a brown trouser movement in which grown men ran about in shorts. And it was incredibly funny and incredibly damaging. And they were furious, the fascists, because the one thing fascists want to be is taken seriously. You know, they're very, very serious figures.
Yeah, serious people, as fascists.
And the suggestion that you're not and you make people laugh. I mean, you know, Moseley was so cross. I mean, there is a way. There is a way, I think.
Sheffield, can we thank Ian Hislop?
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. We must leave. Well, I hope you enjoyed that hour of mirth. Still don't actually know what the naughtiest thing is that Ian Hislop's ever done, but I imagine it's very, very naughty indeed. Huge thanks to the Sheffield Documentary Festival and for Ian Hislop for allowing us to use this for the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. There'll surely be more live ones coming up. News Roast will be actually live at the Wilderness Festival in early August if you're there. And we'll be recording that too, so we'll be bringing that to you. I hope you are having a lovely day wherever you are. And there will be more News Roast from the studio coming soon.